My name is Gary Gamashta. I'm the host of this session, and I want to welcome you all to Colorado, number one, and to the conference. The name of this session is An Overview of Nikkei Incarceration, World War II, Assembly, Relocation, Isolation, Segregation, and Internment Camps. And our moderator is Mr. Jeff Burton. Before we get started, there's a few housekeeping items that I'd like to address. First of all, if everyone would please turn off their cell phones, would appreciate that. And for those that need to know where the restrooms are, they are out the door to the right. Just follow the windows to the restroom. And please, if you would refrain from taping either video or audio taping, please. This session is being professionally recorded, and the audio files will be available on the janum.org website following the conference.
Welcome, everybody. My name is Jeff Burton, and I'm an archaeologist at Manzanar National Historic Site. And today I'm joined by two, possibly three, distinguished scholars. To my left here is Professor Tetsu Kashima from the University of Washington. And on the end there is Louis Fasse, also from the University of Washington. And Jim Hiribashi is going to be joining us shortly. He's a professor from the University of Washington also. And we are short on time. If you want further information on these, you can read their bios in the program. But believe me, you couldn't ask for a better panel on this subject. What we're going to be talking about is we're going to try to give you an overview of the many types of camps and experiences Japanese Americans went through during World War II. Louis is going to be talking about the assembly centers. Jim is going to be talking about the relocation centers and the Tule Lake Segregation Center. And Tetsu is going to have take up all the rest of the sites. And we each got 15 minutes. And so if you could hold your applause to the very end of the session, we'll have time for your questions. So without further ado, I'm going to give you a short introduction to the sites of confinement and hopefully show why these are important, show that, you know, places have memories, the land remembers, the rocks hold memories, and what was left behind forces us to remember. With over 70 sites in 28 states, it's hard to forget. In March 42 through May of 42, the military set up assembly centers, 17 of these. And what's important, you won't be tested on this graph, but what's important is know that the experience of the people really varied from, you know, the mayor assembly center, which was only had 245 people and was occupied for less than a month, to Santa Anita, where there was over 18,000 people and it was open for 7 months. The assembly centers were all quickly built, just thrown together. They were located at racetracks, fairgrounds, mill sites, labor camps. In Arizona, there was one in an abandoned CCC camp at Mayer. There was another camp in Arizona that was readied, but so many Japanese Americans moved across the exclusion line, which just meant moving from one side of Phoenix to another, that camp was never used. From the assembly centers, people were sent to 10 inland relocation centers that were located in deserts, swamps, and other underpopulated areas. And here you also have a range of sizes, with Amachi, the smallest, with a little over 7,000 people, to Poston, which had over 17,000. And the numbers of people in these camps, you know, really made the experiences different. The more crowded it seems, the more turmoil there were in these camps. Two of the relocation centers are National Park Service Unit. Of course, Manzanar was made a National Historic Site in 1992, and Minidoka was made a National Monument in 2001. We have four relocation centers in the area that the enduring communities includes, and that's Gila River and Poston, which are both on Indian reservations, and then Topaz and, of course, Amache. The others are Jerome and Rower in Arkansas, and Heart Mountain in Wyoming, and Tule Lake in Northern California. After the riot at Manzanar, the War Relocation Authority decided to remove the so-called troublemakers from Manzanar, and they set up an isolation center at Moab, which was in operation for 7 months, and there was 49 people that were interned there. This included the troublemakers from Manzanar, but also from other camps, and these troublemakers were just designated by the camp officials. There was really not necessarily any actual crime or even thought of any crime. As I said, it was open for 7 months. It was found to be inadequate. It was really falling apart, and it was then moved to a Indian boarding school at Loop, which is on the Navajo Indian Reservation in Arizona. In that camp, they actually had fences and guard towers installed, and the 71 inmates there were outnumbered by guards by 2-1. And that one was closed in December 43, and everybody was transferred to Tule Lake. Tule Lake at that time was converted to a segregation center as, you know, a result of the loyalty questionnaire. And at that time, the 8-foot-high man-proof fence was installed. It was topped with barbed wire. They added extra guard towers, extra troops. They also built a stockade and a jail within the camp to further segregate people within the camp. And the population of Tule Lake rose to over 18,000. Other WRA camps that were used, Cow Creek at Death Valley was used after the Manzanar riot, kind of a refuge for 65 people from Manzanar who were considered super patriots. They were on a death list and had to be taken out of camp, and they lived there for a few months before they transferred to jobs in other parts of the country. There was a CCC camp at Tule Lake, which was used twice. In March of 1943, it housed 100 Japanese-American men who refused to answer the loyalty questionnaire. And in October 1943, 243 Japanese-Americans were brought in from other camps to break a farm labor strike at the camp. And it was unknown that they were brought in for a strike. And at the Antelope Springs camp near Topaz was used for recreation. When right after December 7th, the first Niseis were Iseis were arrested. They were taken to, you know, the Immigration and Naturalization Service detention centers where they were held. And most of these are still existing buildings and facilities. There was two large camps at Sharp Park and Tuna Canyon, and these were mostly held people that were coming back for interviews and hearings. Both of those are pretty much been destroyed. After they were given hearings at the detention centers, they were sent to Justice Department camps. The most notable is Fort Missoula and Fort Lincoln. By April of 42, there was over 2,000 interned at those places. Fort Lincoln was also reactivated in 1945 for a short time for people removed from Tule Lake, so-called recalcitrants that gave up their American citizenship. And also interesting is Segoville, which was a prison that held 50 Japanese-American women, mostly foreign Japanese language teachers. And there was a small work camp at Kuski in Idaho that held a small number of men, mostly people that volunteered to be on a work crew rather than be in a relocation center. Crystal City in Texas was a family facility where Japanese Americans could live in a family unit. They actually had three-room cottages. It also included Germans and Italians and 600 Hawaiians and over 600 from Peru. And because of the Peruvians and their complicated status, it was the longest occupied camp. It was didn't close until late 1947. Santa Fe camp was initially opened in 1942, and it had a little over 800 people. There was a fire that destroyed several buildings, so it had to be closed and people sent elsewhere. But it was also expanded and reused in June of 45, also for people that were removed from the Tule Lake Segregation Center. And there was over 2,000 of them, and those were non-citizens and those that had given up their citizenship. Fort Stanton, which is also in New Mexico in the mountains, was actually a internment camp for Germans that was converted to a POW camp. And it also had a small facility that the Germans built that held 17 Japanese Americans that were removed from Santa Fe because they couldn't be controlled at Santa Fe, so they were even moved further away from everybody else. One camp that a lot of people don't know about is actually the first family internment camp for Japanese Americans during World War II. And this is at the old Raton camp. It was a CCC camp where some railroad workers from Clovis, New Mexico were held. And there was 32 men, women, and children that were held there from January 42 to December 42 before they were transferred to Topaz and Poston. And what's interesting about this camp is there's this nice Japanese-style garden that you can barely see in amongst the trees there. And, you know, there's no proof that the Japanese Americans built this, but at CCC camps, usually there aren't gardens at barracks. And also we have this nice memo by the Swedish consulate that came to inspect the camp and said the Japanese Americans were busying themselves building gardens. There's a lot of U.S. Army internment camps that held Japanese Americans. We have 23 identified so far. Most of these are at existing military bases where they built compounds to hold them for short periods of time. And a lot of these were Hawaiians. For some reason, the Hawaiians were moved around a lot, so they saw a lot of the country. One of the most notable ones, one that was built specifically as a POW camp, was at Lordsburg, New Mexico. And there's still a lot of nice remains there, and a great museum. If you're ever in Lordsburg, stop at the county museum there. They have a whole room just for the POW and internment exhibits with some nice Japanese-American artifacts, you know, artwork that was produced in the camp. Lordsburg is also infamous for where two Japanese-American elderly men were shot trying to escape, supposedly trying to escape. That's they were actually stragglers because they were so sick they couldn't keep up with the rest of the group. In Hawaii, each of the islands had an initial internment camp run by the military. And eventually one larger camp was built. It also served prisoners of war. And the military intelligence language schools are also an important part of the story. A lot of people volunteered out of the camps, and this is where they ended up. The facility was first in the Presidio. It had to be moved out of the exclusion zone to Camp Savage, and then in 1945 to Fort Snelling. And Fort Snelling is now a state park, and they have a nice exhibit on the Japanese-American, what they did to help the war effort. The U.S. Army training sites are also an important part of the story. Camp McCoy in Wisconsin, where the 100th Battalion from Hawaii was initially sent, and Camp Shelby, where they were sent after that and were joined by the 442. And we also have federal prisons, and this is where people from the relocation centers that refused to register for the draft until their rights were restored were sent. At Heart Mountain, the young draft resistors were sent to McNeil Island, and the older ones to Leavenworth. And from Jerome, they were sent to Texarkana. And for the most part, these are all still used as prisons. The one exception is the Catalina Honor Camp, which is a work camp in the mountains of Arizona, and it held resistors from Machi, Topaz, and Minidoka. And this is also where Gordon Hirabashi spent his prison term when he lost his case before the Supreme Court. And, you know, interestingly, you know, there's also resistors at Poston, but the court just fined them a dollar and sent them back to the relocation center. And at Tule Lake, the judge just dismissed the case as ridiculous, trying to draft these people out of Tule Lake. And finally, we have all these additional sites. We have, you know, Japanese language schools. We have control stations and evacuation sites. resettlement sites, local jails where people were taken out of the camps and held for various lengths of time. And we also have cemeteries. You know, there's that Manzanar Rower, Namachi still has their cemeteries. But there's also cemeteries like at Powell, Wyoming, where they were relocated from the main camp at Heart Mountain. But there's also cemeteries like at Fort Bliss National Cemetery, which was the closest cemetery to Lordsburg. And that's where the two elderly gentlemen that were shot were interned. And I think that's it. And I'll turn it over to Louis, and he's going to be talking about the assembly centers. Oh, thanks. Here's Jim. And I'm not sure if I should introduce him as Gordon's brother or Lane's father. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. I'm Louis Fissay, and I'm very proud to be a part of this weekend gathering. On March 30th, 1942, 257 Nikkei residents of Bainbridge Island, Washington, walked onto a Cross Sound ferry to Seattle under military guard and boarded a train bound for the Manzanar Reception Center in California's Owens Valley, 200 miles east of Los Angeles. This transport began the forced exile of 92,000 Japanese Americans directly from their homes in Washington, Oregon, California, and Arizona into so-called assembly centers. There, they remained for approximately 100 days until their transfer to permanent relocation centers located in remote regions of the country. Over the past 40 years, many books have been published on the relocation centers. And in the past decade, significant light shed on the internment camps for Japanese nationals held as enemy aliens. To date, however, little has been written about the assembly center experience, and the first scholarly book on the subject will not be published until next year, 67 years after the fact. Why is this? First, the assembly center period lasted just 7 months, brief compared to the overall incarceration experience. Second, until recently, Army archives have been more difficult to access than War Relocation Authority records. And third, for many assembly center survivors, the trauma of their abrupt transition from freedom to captivity has blurred memories and, in some cases, erased them altogether. Some of you here today may therefore know less about the assembly center experience than other aspects of the incarceration. For the next few minutes, then, I would like to provide some highlights of this transitional experience. The Army's task of first evicting, then sheltering 100,000 men, women, and children was daunting. In early March 1942, planners appropriated 15 existing public facilities located near city limits with significant Nikkei populations and built a 16th Manzanar from scratch. The assembly center sites included 13 in California and one each in Arizona, Oregon, and Washington. Fairgrounds, racetracks, and livestock pavilions provided acreage and infrastructure necessary to assemble the centers quickly. Built for temporary occupancy, the centers offered few amenities and meager social services. Inmates ate in mess halls and slept in noisy barracks while enjoying little privacy. At several centers, notably the Santa Anita and Tanforan racetracks, many unlucky families occupied whitewashed animal stalls that reeked of manure. Poet James Mitsui provides a poignant detail from his family's Tanforan experience. Hay, horsehair, and manure are whitewashed to the boards. In the corner, a white spider is suspended in the shadow of a white spider web. As the Army's forced evacuation approached, Nikkei communities prepared for exile. Advertisements appeared in local newspapers, and readers soon learned there were bargains to be had. Japanese evacuation necessitates immediate sale, 55-room brick hotel, best linens, furnishings, steam heat, steady tenants. 1936 DeSoto sedan, attached overdrive, gas saver transmission, 4 new tires, evacuation forces sale. Problems for farm operators often proved complex. Long-term leases had to be transferred, expensive farm machinery disposed of or stored by sympathetic neighbors. Until the last minute, the government pressured growers to plant for the 1942 season, equating continued production to a measure of national loyalty. Soon, crop neglect or damage elevated to an act of sabotage. The eviction operation went smoothly, in part because of civil control stations the Army set up in community halls, school gymnasiums, and other public places throughout Nikkei centers of population. There, government personnel, registered families, provided pre-induction medical examinations, and helped arrange for storage or sale of properties. Assigned 5-digit identification numbers relegated family units to anonymity. The Itois of Seattle, family 10710. The Unos, 10936. On each appointed evacuation day, families arrived at pre-arranged gathering points, dragging their personal belongings. The gathering area at 8th Avenue and Lane Street, near the heart of Seattle's Japantown, was located in the city's red light district. Shosuke Sasaki remembered baggage lining both sides of the street, and Nikkei standing in a chilling spring drizzle, awaiting the order to board buses. Among them, his sister and 2 infant children. The door of a brothel opened, and the madam invited the 3 into her parlor to wait out the rain, an act of kindness recalled with emotion a half century later. New Assembly Center arrivals faced strangers in unaccustomed close quarters, sharing communal realities of mess halls, latrines, shower rooms, and the barracks themselves. Late at night was no exception, for open spaces between apartments amplified sounds that ricocheted through the entire barrack. Insomniacs endured snoring, coughing, whispering, arguing, crying, pacing, and sounds of lovemaking. As rain fell on the tar paper roofs at Puyallup, water trickled down low-angled slopes through cracks and onto blankets, clothes, and faces. Such misery informed the early experience of Nikkei from Washington to Arizona as they endured the shock of their sudden loss of freedom. Nevertheless, inmates built a semblance of community. Many went to work, most to the mess halls, with others employing specialized skills as clerks, organizers, and medical aides. Nisei teachers and volunteers guided young charges through vacation school. The payroll ranged from $8 a month for unskilled labor to $16 for professional workers. In 2008 dollars, overworked physicians earned a meager $212 per month. Other workers organized recreational activities to help stave off boredom and boost morale. Boxing, kendo, sumo, basketball, horseshoe pitching. Softball leagues provoked instant intra-camp rivalries. Women formed knitting, sewing, and crochet groups, while older men set up go and shogi tournaments. Dance-crazy young people headed for the recreation halls to swing to the recorded sounds of Glenn Miller. Yet for most people, absent distractions provided by employment and volunteerism, time passed slowly. Tomoko Inoue remembered the summer boredom she and friends experienced at the Puyallup Assembly Center. There was this space between the barracks. When it was really hot, everybody would go to one side of this lane, lean against the building, and just sit there. And later on in the day, when the sun changed its course, we'd go to the other side. Although physically isolated from their former communities, inmates accessed news and world events through AM radio and mail subscriptions to English language newspapers, including Pacific Citizen. In addition, each assembly center published a mimeographed newsletter with Nikkei editorial and production staffs. Some having evocative names, Wallerga Wasp, Pinedale Lager, Tanforan Totalizer, Fresno Grapevine, all issues were distributed free. Through them, center managers communicated regulations and directives, while editors reported center-wide happenings such as births and deaths, ball scores, and Sunday church schedules. Content was censored, leaving the editor of the Manzanar Free Press to note privately, the only thing free about his publication was the subscription fee. With no access to telephone or freedom to move about, letter writing provided the sole means of communication with the outside world. Although the newsletters were censored, first-class mail passed freely. Early incompetence by Army planners led to occupancy of assembly centers before installation of refrigeration and other safe food storage equipment. For a brief time, inmates ate Army rations designed for troops in the field. While food on mess hall tables soon became more palatable, healthful sanitary conditions evolved more slowly, resulting in public health threats everywhere. Outbreaks of diarrhea plagued most assembly centers because of inexperienced workers and improper oversight. In early May, spoiled Vienna sausages caused a severe flare-up among inmates at Puyallup. Symptoms emerged after curfew, and the commotion led to near panic by sentries in the guard tower. Flashlights helping light the way, with all public stalls occupied, pinpoints of light moved erratically in the darkness. Fearing an insurrection, sentries manned the spotlights and called for reinforcements. But with order soon restored, tragedy was averted, and the epidemic passed quickly. Given the crowded and unsanitary conditions at most assembly centers, it is surprising more frequent, if not serious, outbreaks of gastroenteritis did not take place. Most health care was provided by Nikkei doctors, nurses, dentists, and pharmacists, themselves inmates. The center's temporary status relegated medical facilities to infirmaries or emergency hospitals. Even so, Army statisticians recorded a total of 5,981 births, 271 operating room surgeries, and in the month of August alone, 30,000 outpatient visits. With the nation's farm labor crisis deepening, as many draft-age workers entered military service or took on higher-paying jobs in the war industry, sugar processors turned to the assembly centers as an untapped labor source. Recruitment at the Portland and Puyallup assembly centers began in mid-May, and by the time the assembly center period ended, nearly 1,600 strong-backed volunteers from half a dozen centers worked the sugar beet fields of the American West. By November, Nikkei farmhands harvested 25% of Idaho's sugar beet crop, with the state's farmers expressing gratitude. Nisei college students, their educations on West Coast campuses abruptly suspended, had slimmer opportunities to leave the assembly centers. While the next 3 years would see over 4,000 students entering inland colleges and universities, the student relocation program began modestly in the assembly centers with 360 transfers. The Army opposed student relocation on national security grounds and imposed sufficient restrictions permitting only a few colleges and universities to participate. Students had to document their financial resources and undergo cumbersome FBI intelligence checks. As a result, most Nisei prepared their college education applications while in the relocation centers. Transfer to the relocation centers began in June and continued throughout October. Wartime demands to move troops on the nation's rail lines forced the Army to use recommissioned passenger cars, hulks that generated universal complaints from Nikkei passengers and officials and added to the humiliation of incarceration. Dirty, with inadequate water pressure, faltering air condition, and sealed windows preventing air circulation, only the passing landscape provided temporary diversions from the misery. On November 1, 1942, 6 days after the final transfer of inmates from the Santa Anita Assembly Center to the Manzanar Relocation Center, the Army, under prior agreement with the War Relocation Authority, turned over jurisdiction of 111,000 Japanese Americans. The Assembly Center period then came to a close. One silver lining to the difficult Assembly Center period may be that life in these holding pens prepared inmates for the several years of incarceration that lay ahead. I will leave you with Sharon Tanage's insight from her own experience. I think that was the best adjustment, really, the Army could give us, to herd us all together to get us used to queuing up in lines and being a bit more patient and learning to get along because we were in such tight quarters. I think without them knowing it, it was the best thing to do. When we went to Minidoka, the trauma wasn't there. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm sorry I was late getting senile and I forgot to check the schedule. Much to my surprise, it was not 3 o'clock, but 1 o'clock that I was supposed to be. But anyway, since Lewis has given you some of the details of the camp, I'm going to pick up with a kind of a personal story from the first incarceration to the second one, as far as I'm concerned. Now, I grew up in a small rural farming community between Seattle and Tacoma. And because all the people in Seattle were put into the Western Washington Fairgrounds, mentioned by Lewis, I guess you're going to have a book coming out pretty soon. Did you mention
yes.
that?
No, but I am.
It's going to be on the Western Washington campgrounds, euphemistically called Camp Harmony. But all the Seattle people filled up the local fairgrounds so that we were put on trains and shipped down to Pinedale, which is a kind of suburb of Fresno. Now, I'd never been on a train before. And so we were taken down to the train station in Auburn, Washington, and sent down. Oh, just maybe a year ago, the Fresno community decided to establish a memorial at Pinedale, put a committee together. And somehow or another, they found that I was an inmate there. So they asked me to come down to their groundbreaking dedication ceremonies and asked me to be the keynote. And so my cousin and I, my cousin lives in the same area in Marin County in the Bay Area, in San Francisco area. He and I drove down to Fresno for that dedication ceremony. And I said, my cousin and I took our first train ride 65 years ago to come down to Pinedale. And as we were driving down this time, we were hoping that we'd get a better reception than last time. Now, it somewhat destroyed, that experience somewhat destroyed the family. Of course, Gordon didn't go, so one member of the family is gone. There are four other kids in the family and my parents, and we're put into the one-room barrack. And as Louis mentioned, there's, you know, it's, the walls went up only to the ceiling. The rafters are up there, and it was open all the way down the barracks so that everybody could hear anything else that happened. And I relied upon that to sort of, you know, I was only 15 at the time, and I was relying on that to do what I wanted to do and disobey my parents and all that. And I relied on the open network there to keep my parents from reprimanding me, because everybody could hear, and there'd be a lot of gossip and everything like that. So, you know, I hung out with the boys, formed gangs. We used to hang around in the buildings. You know, there'd be a common toilet area and shower area. And we'd look around there and scare the girls at night and things like that. Play baseball during the day. And I learned to play cards. Now, my parents are very strict Christians, and we never played cards because they associated that with gambling. And I learned to play poker and pinochle, and late, you know, stayed out as long as I wanted to, and then I'd come home at night and then have the open rafters to protect me from any kind of reprimand. And one night my mother had enough of it. She lit into me, and the whole barracks found out. And it's like that. I never ate with the family. I ate with the boys, the gang, you know, because it's mess hall. We can go and do whatever we want. And we didn't have any money, you know. So I got a job washing dishes, $8 a month. And we'd buy candy at the canteen and things like that, but that was it. That's what I remember, is just the family, the discipline, and everything falling apart. And then we were shipped up to Tule Lake. And it patterned more or less the same, barrack rooms. But I did, with my friends, got a job working on a road crew. And so we were driven out of camp to dig up cinders, lava fields up there. And we would be paid, I think, $12 a month, so it was better. And we would hide in the piles of sheetrock that they had around, and we would play cards and do things like that whenever we could sneak away from the people that were expecting us to help them on the road crew. We did things like that and played ball. I remember we wanted to do some track, and so my friend and I, we jumped into an empty irrigation ditch here, sneaking around, and they're building some buildings in the area for, I guess they're going to do some war work, making equipment. And so we stole a big, long 2x4 to build a, pole vault pole standard. And so then my friend and I each grabbed a 2x4 and jumped into the irrigation ditch, and we're sneaking away, and my friend dropped his side. And I said, "What are you doing?" He says, "Well, the guard blew his whistle." And I says, "What?" And we dropped the 2x4 and ran away. And we went back there when the crew was working, and there are people in camps, so that they didn't care. And we took a longer 2x4 and made our equipment. But we did things like that. And then pretty soon school started. And they, after about 2 weeks, school, we didn't have enough chairs, or no desks, no books. And the teachers were older Niseis who had some college training, and they were the teachers in the class. And so after about 2 weeks, they closed down the school. And we had to go out and help harvest crops in the Klamath Falls area, potatoes. And while the school was still closed down, my parents were taken by deputy sheriffs back up to Seattle to attend my brother's trial. And my father had arranged with his friends to get a work furlough and to leave camp. And while he was gone, he asked his friends to take me. And they had kids about my age, so that I happily went along with them. And I left Tule Lake on a work furlough to Weezer, Idaho, which is on the Oregon-Idaho border. It's kind of a redneck town. And we didn't get, I'd be called names on the streets and have rocks thrown at me and things like that. I got kicked out of the local restaurants. They wouldn't serve Japanese. And kicked out of the public swimming pools. But I laid out a year and harvested sugar beets and potatoes. I'd never seen a sugar beet before in my life, And if I ever see another potato, I hope it's cooked and on my plate. That's what I did a whole year, laid out of school. And then I went to Weezer High School for my junior year, and it's pretty well accepted. There are quite a few Japanese kids out there at that time, and we played in the sports and things like that. And but still, as I say, we were kicked out of restaurants and things like that also. And then I moved up to Spokane to finish high school. Gordon had come out of prison, and he was working for the Quakers up there, helping other Japanese to relocate out of camps. And the camp experience, well, there were, of course, 10 in the country. Two in California, Minidoka in Idaho, Topaz in Utah, Polson and Gila River in Arizona, Heart Mountain in Colorado, and Amachi in Wyoming, Roar and Jerome in Arkansas. Now, they're usually in fairly desolate areas, and a couple of them were in reservation camps, Indian reservation camps, areas. And of course, the Indians weren't put into the best locations to begin with. The experiences, as far as I was concerned, was just a real change. As a matter of fact, the area that I grew up in, between Seattle and Tacoma, the rural area, was a fairly large Japanese American community, and about 3/4 of my class in grade school were Niseis. So we were the majority in that area. So the kinds of experiences, I think, that really, really changed our lifestyles and everything else, and I think it's really affected the way in which I would have been brought up had we had no life changes at all. So anyway, I've got my warnings.
Good afternoon. After December 7th, 1941, my mother kept a packed suitcase next to the sofa in our residence at the Oakland Buddhist Church. Although my father did not know when it would happen, he believed that eventually the FBI would come to arrest him, as they had arrested other religious leaders on the Pacific West Coast. Thus, the suitcase in the living room. When I heard this story as an adult, it seemed strange to me that my father, a Buddhist priest, and from all accounts, a very law-abiding person, would worry that he would be arrested. As it turned out, my father was never arrested later, nor did any other of the priests among the Jodo Shinshu and non-Konko Kyo churches in the Bay Area were not arrested. In the earlier program, Nob Fukuda talked about his father, Reverend Fukuda, the Konko Church, and he was one of the ones that was early arrested, even just after December 7th. But my father, as a Jodo Shinshu priest, and others, even the bishop of the Buddhist Churches of America at that time, actually it was the North American Buddhist Mission, were not arrested. My father, mother, older brother, and I was a one-year-old child, were taken as a military necessity and kept for 3 years at the Topaz War Relocation Authority Center. I like to tell people that my only possible wartime threat was what I carried in the bottom of my diapers as I ran around Topaz. This presentation, the way Jeff Burton presented it, was going to talk about all the other camps, but he did such a superb job in giving you actual pictures of it that I'm going to focus really on the Justice Department camps. I'll abbreviate that as DOJ, the War Department camps that are along with it, and then just bring in the incarceration camp to show the relationship between them. Unlike the WRA camp, the Department of Justice and DOJ operated separate camps, some starting as early as December 7th, and as you heard from Nob Fukuda this afternoon, or this morning, some of you, Crystal City stayed in existence until 1947, 2 years after the end of the war, and that's where their family was at. The reason for discussing these DOJ and War Department camps, I think, is because that many people are simply unaware of the existence and purposes of these camps. Yet, they are important consequences of what I call the total imprisonment process of persons of Japanese ancestry during World War II. Second, I contend that there exists a symbiotic relationship between the war relocation camps and the war and DOJ camps. I'll explain this statement a bit later, unless I'm giving it a warning too. Within this limited time, I can only delve into selected aspects of the Justice and War Department camps. Notably absent is the story of the Issei from Latin American countries and other arrested German and Italian nationals who also found themselves in the Army and DOJ camp. This discussion will raise issues of terminology, the authority for the camps, the process itself of the internment process, 10 types of camps, and the symbiotic relationship between the DOJ and Army internment camps with the WRA incarceration centers. First, terminology. Then Major Carl R. Bendetson has said that about the removal of the Japanese Americans from the West Coast that, quote, he conceived the method, formulated the details, and directed the evacuation of 120,000 persons of Japanese ancestry from the military areas. What a guy. Although I disagree with most of the statements he has made just after the war and for many years after, even testifying in front of the commission hearings, although I disagree with most of his statements justifying the relocation, I do agree with him on one particular point. He states that, quote, Executive Order 9066 of President Roosevelt interned no one. Okay? Executive Order 9066 of President Roosevelt interned no one. The issue here is with the term internment, for me. This is not just a trivial semantic issue. Present-day apologists for the World War II exclusion castigates as erroneous the common practice of using the terms incarceration and internment as if they were synonymous. They imply that even if one part of the assertion questioning the government's policy in terms of the mass exclusion is tainted, then the apologists say so might other aspects of the questioning of the entire exclusion. So you see people like Bendetson saying about the particular term that it's wrong in terms of conflating internment with incarceration. If we look at this slide, I hope so. Which one? This one, I think. This one? Shift. This one. Okay. Back. Oh, here's. If we look at this slide, and there's some problems here, but let me just briefly do it because there's not much time. I want to talk about internment as referring to the imprisonment of civilian enemy nationals, German, Italian, and Japanese. I want to use the word incarceration to refer to actions taken to imprison U.S. or Canadian citizens under specific authorization, and also those ISEs who were not taken under the internment. Because without dividing them, what we've done is really subsumed, I think, the Justice Department camps without making it very clear that they are very different from the war relocation camps. If I can make that case to really separate out the words internment and incarceration, I have to make the case that they are entirely separate. One is to look at the authority by which each of those internment or incarceration processes occurred. For the internment process, the DOJ and Army camps that Jeff Burton showed you in terms of INS and the Army, their authority came under the U.S. Alien Enemies Act of 1798. And it states, upon declaration of war and the president makes a public proclamation, native citizen subjects 14 years and older could be apprehended, restrained, secured, and removed as enemy aliens. Notice that what they're talking about is enemy nationals. Executive Order 9066, as you all know, authorizes the Secretary of War to designate certain areas from which any or all persons may be excluded, and with respect to which the right of any person to enter, remain in, or leave shall be subject to whatever restrictions he may impose in his discretion. That is, anyone. It's not ethnic specific. So one difference here is that under Alien Enemies Act, it had to be an enemy alien national, although there are some NISAs taken. But under executive order, anyone can be taken so long as an area is so designated. Overall, there was a particular process with respect to the internment camps that were different from the incarceration camps. And I think all of you know about the incarceration camps with respect to assembly center, incarceration camps, and then usually just waiting until the end, or they can go on work furlough, they can go on college leaves, etc., etc. For the internment process, we start at the top with German, Italian, and Japanese nationals who had been, in many cases, pre-designated through the Justice Department Special Defense Unit and the Office of Naval Intelligence's compiling of lists of people who are seen to be suspect. And so when we went to war and suddenly we had the Alien Enemies Act, then people could be quickly arrested on December 7th. Indeed, this gets more complex, but that's why the arrest could happen on December 7th. They were not willy-nilly. They were not ad hoc. We had lists of people to pick up. They could be taken down, and then they could be put into a detention camp that, again, you saw. The detention station is the equivalent to the assembly centers, and this was usually the INS camps. If they were released, the Germans and Italians could go home, but the Japanese Issei's could go home unless it's after February 19th, in which case they would come under WRA. If they weren't released, what happens is they were given hearings. They were given hearings, and if they were released, then the German and Italians can go home. The Japanese, usually by this time, it was after WRA, so they'd be put into a WRA camp. Then, however, in 1943, the Army found itself, after the hearings from the INS, they went to the Army camps. In 43, the Army found that it was getting prisoners of war from the European theater. In fact, we had about 500,000 German and Italian POWs who came in, and the Army said, we can't hold them and the civilian prisoners of war, so can you take them? And the Justice Department said yes, and so these Japanese were taken back out. That's why, for many of you, you hear about people going to Lordsburg, which is an Army camp, and then from there, going to Santa Fe, which is an INS camp. Is that clear? That's why they went to many camps. Another reason, I have to go on. If they were released, the German Italians can go home, the Japanese Issei. After they were in there, they were given a separate hearing, a second hearing, and there were three outcomes, as in the first: parole, imprisonment, or release. If they were interned, they had to stay in camps, and they were either repatriated or deported. If they were citizens, they could be expatriated or be repatriated. But if they were paroled or if they were released, then they would go over here to the WRA camp. The Germans, the Italians just can go home. Okay, that is a quick schematic of the process used. There were, in fact, many places where these camps were at, 5 minutes, and you saw this kind of slide before. So there are numbers of places where they could be held. There were actually 10 types of camps, I contend. There were detention stations run by the Justice and INS who held enemy aliens. Second, internment camps. This is once they were given their hearings, then they were put into permanent camps if they were kept for permanent internment. Again, Justice and later War Department camps. But for the camps that Louis Fizet talked about, this is assembly centers, initially run by the War Department, the Wartime Civil Control Administration, WCCA, nationals, and it held nationals and citizens. The next was relocation camp that Jim Hirabashi talked about, and then isolation, and that pro-WRA camp in Cow Creek is the one that Jeff Burton talked about, number five. Number six is the Tui Lake Center, where the, quote, dissidents were taken. And number seven, the Justice Department had its own segregation camp in Fort Stanton, and where they also brought many of the renunciant Nisseis, only about 17 of them, but they were separated from Santa Fe. Eight, institutions, hospitals, mental asylums. Nine, refugee camp. We had about 1,000 Jews taken from Europe who were brought over and put into a camp under WRA control in the East Coast. And finally, there were internment hotels run by the State Department, holding especially German, Japanese, and Italian diplomats and ambassadors before they were exchanged, especially on the USS Scripps and the Swedish neutral ship. This is the, there are, so when I talk about the imprisoned experience, it's not just incarceration. It's just not internment. There are a whole host of other camps. Okay. Just to give you a flavor for it, this is the Kennedy internment camp in Texas. And this is a place that held a number of people from Latin American countries along with internees from the United States. You can see on this slide at Kennedy that in the front row, there are many persons of Japanese ancestry. But in the back, you see Caucasian faces. In a sense, most of them are German, and there are a few Italians. The total number of people taken to the assembly centers, I'm talking too fast because it's only 5 minutes. The total number of people taken to the DOJ and camps in terms of internment, my figure comes to about 34,000, and of that number, the majority, about 53%, were persons of Japanese ancestry. There were very few Italians, and the other majority were Germans. Another place that we've talked about, too, is the Segalville, Texas internment camp. It's a women camp, but what you see is they had children. The children weren't given to the males, and so here's a picture of the Segalville internment camp with the children playing. And this is the overview of the entire Segalville camp.
You want those pictures?
Yeah. Where am I now? Oh. You know, I'm going to have to end this. I'd like to talk about the symbiotic relationship between the WRA and the War Relocation Authority, but time doesn't allow me to do so. So what I want to do is to skip all the way to the fact that The question is, why is it important to hear and know about the various camps used to hold innocent people during World War II? Simply put, we need to educate the people And we, the people, must come to understand what went on in the Second World War, because this story, I think, is still virtually unknown unless you have a particular family where individuals in the family happen to be in there. And then the question is, well, what happened to Grandpa and Grandma? It must not happen again. As George Santa Anna offered, and I'll quote him, "Progress, far from consisting in change, depends on retentiveness. When experience is not retained, as among savages, infancy is perpetual. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. This is the condition of children and barbarians, in whom instinct has learned nothing from experience. We must learn from our past." Thank you.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have any time for questions, but I'd like to thank all our speakers, and I'm sure you could catch any one of us and ask any questions between sessions or after the sessions or anytime you come across us. We'll be happy to take your questions, but thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Loved your story.
Well,
loved the 2x4 story. That was just terrific.
I didn't.